I was hoping I might get through the broadcast today without saying the word, well, the word that describes the big bill the Senate unveiled this week. Sadly, though, that is not going to happen. From American Public Media, this is Market Flash. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Friday, the 23rd of June, I believe it is. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We are going to get right to it. What the heck has happened in this economy since Monday? For that, we've got Rachel Abrams from the New York Times, Sheila Kolhatkar of the New Yorker. They are both in our studio in New York. Hey.
Hey there. Hi.
All right, so there's the word, healthcare. You ready? Here it is. Healthcare. I know it was a big surprise. Sheila, let me start with you. And something that I wonder if maybe it's missing in this bigger debate about the healthcare bill. It is, first and foremost, even more than being a bill about healthcare, it's a tax bill, right? And it's a tax bill in which a big chunk of the gains go to the top distribution, income distribution, and the expenses go to the bottom, the where that money's coming out of. And I wonder if what we're having here in this country is a conversation about wealth distribution without really having it. You know what I mean?
Sure. I mean, there's really no other way to read this bill. I think it was remarkable that reporters over the course of the last week couldn't find any Republican senators to sort of articulate what problems the bill solves in the healthcare system, because the answer, basically, everyone agrees are no problems are solved by this. However, it does reverse some small tax increases that were included in the Affordable Care Act, which helped pay for expanded coverage for people at the lower end of the income chain. And essentially, it amounts to an enormous tax cut for people earning over $250,000 a year and up. And it places a much greater expense and burden and stress on many Americans at the lower end of the spectrum, including 40 million children, approximately. So it's worrying in that regard.
Rachel, as you think about this, I guess I wonder why that discussion is being missed, the larger concept of wealth redistribution, just because we're hearing the politicians say whatever the politicians are going to say. But the larger picture is in the hue and cry not being talked about so much.
I think it's just so hard to compare the two. One is a really complicated a health bill. Another is a really complicated tax overhaul, which we haven't even seen a final version of. We don't know the specifics about what is going to be proposed. So we've seen some estimates about certain types of cuts to health care that could help provide cuts to wealthier people. But since we don't know exactly what we're comparing, it's a little bit like apples and oranges right now.
Well, so Sheila, let me get to that point, because Paul Ryan, Speaker of the House, made a big speech on health policy, on tax policy rather, this week. He promised to get it done by 2017. First of all, are you willing to bet any money on that?
I will definitely not be betting any of my hard-earned cash on that.
Which goes to the point, which is there are so many moving parts. There is so much else going on. And this was big, you know, when Comey got fired. This whole the economic agenda has been disrupted. But there is still no economic agenda coming out of this White House and the Capitol.
Well, so again, the healthcare bill, the lack of tax bill of any kind really points to the dysfunction that seems to have really taken hold in Congress. And it's something that we have to just sort of keep pointing out, because everything sort of comes back to that. You have a president who was elected on all sorts of sort of populist sounding promises, and a lot of lower middle class voters who were counting on him and throwing their lot in with him to sort of help them out of their economic stress and insecurity. And then he seems completely disconnected from what's going on. And the Republicans in Congress are actually just pursuing the agenda they had before, which actually voters did not really like or respond to, which is why none of the traditional Republican candidates ended up being their nominee. But they're just on their own train trying to pursue their main goal, which is, cutting taxes for the higher end. And it seems that no matter how many times you point that out, they won't acknowledge it. And it's leading to this sort of weird gridlock that we have.
So, Rachel, you remember you were on like a month ago, and we talked about that conversation you had with the voters out in like Pennsylvania someplace.
Yeah, and, Western Pennsylvania.
Yeah, and you said, you know, they're not paying attention to any of this stuff. And you said, I wonder if we're doing it wrong. Here we are a month later. It's only gotten worse, right?
I mean, I don't know how to measure media coverage, and I certainly am no media critic, but I definitely do think that people, you know, there's if most web pages for major media organizations are dominated by Comey, you know, for large parts of the week. And if you ask people, what do you care about in lots of places that have lost manufacturing jobs or are suffering economically, they're talking about healthcare. So I'm glad to see that that's on the agenda.
Yeah. All right. We got to go. There's so much more to talk about this stuff anyway. Sheila Kolhatkar at The New Yorker and Rachel Abrams at The New York Times. Thanks, you two. Have a nice weekend, huh?
Thanks, Kai.
Thanks.
All right. Be good. On Wall Street today, small moves, people. Very, very small moves. That's the new normal. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Close observers of the Trumpian dynamic with corporate America might have noticed a change of late. There was a time, right after the election and into the very early days of his administration, when the president leaned and leaned hard to great fanfare on American companies, trying to get them to keep their jobs and their manufacturing bases here and not send them overseas. Boeing, Ford, General Motors all felt sharp presidential elbows. And then there was Carrier, the first and most celebrated example, the Indiana-based air conditioning and refrigeration company that agreed to a plan, sweetened, it has to be said, by millions of dollars in state tax breaks to keep 1,000 jobs in Indiana. But it turns out domestic layoffs are still coming at a lot of those companies, and outsourcing to Mexico and China is still happening. Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman has the update on that.
Carrier now says it'll cut more than 600 jobs at its plant in Indianapolis, though hundreds more will remain. And Ford's now moving some small car production to China after Trump pressured the company not to build the cars in Mexico.
I think that we may have exaggerated the extent to which companies initially bowed to any pressure.
That's labor economist Michael Strain at the American Enterprise Institute. He says, read the fine print. Carrier never made any sweeping promise to maintain or grow manufacturing jobs in the U.S. And business priorities will nearly always be paramount, says Lynn Stout at Cornell Law School.
You can't really threaten companies into keeping jobs in the U.S. They're driven by economic pressures.
Like international tax rates, production costs, and the demands of shareholders.
And one of the best ways to push your share price up temporarily is to reduce your payroll.
And find cheap labor overseas. Stout says it's not that companies are immune from presidential pressure tactics.
Corporations don't like to be publicly criticized, especially by the president. But they're very savvy and they realize this particular president seems to have a very short attention span. And if they just lie low, there's a good chance the issue will blow over.
Political economist Sharon O'Halloran at Columbia says for companies to deliver on any domestic job promises they make, they're dependent on the president delivering what he's promised.
The pro-growth agenda, infrastructure build-out.
She says they're seeing little progress and going their own way to keep serving the bottom line. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
If you're a label reader when you food shop, you might have noticed they were missing. The rest of us, maybe not so much. I'm talking here about country of origin labels, the requirements that went into effect in 2009 that obliged meat packers to identify where the animals were born, raised, and slaughtered. Those requirements were repealed in 2015, but now two rancher groups are suing the Department of Agriculture to get them back. Marketplace's Annie Baxter explains why.
The rancher groups filing the lawsuit say consumers want to purchase meat from animals born, raised, and slaughtered here, and they should be able to know if that's not the case. Right now, for example, pieces of beef from Canada can come across the border to a U.S. processor and get ground into hamburger. That hamburger can be sold without any indication of its origin.
Massive companies that have supply chains all over the world can import beef and pass it off as U.S. beef, and this allows them to drive down the prices they pay U.S. producers.
That's David Moraskin with the law firm Public Justice. He's representing the rancher groups in the lawsuit. Daryl Peel, an ag economist at Oklahoma State University, says there's a good reason the U.S. ditched country of origin labels for pork and beef. They created big headaches for the meat industry. Feedlots and meat packers had to keep foreign and domestic cattle separate.
Packers had to devote shifts or dedicated parts of shifts to slaughtering those animals so that they could get the labeling right when they came through the packing plant.
The World Trade Organization ruled in 2015 in favor of Canada and Mexico that the extra regulations unfairly hurt them. To avoid retaliation in the form of huge taxes, the U.S. repealed the labeling rule for beef and pork. Peel thinks mandating origin labels for meat signals a food safety issue, which he says it's not.
any product that comes in, animals or already processed as meat, has to meet U.S. food safety inspections or it's not allowed in.
But the rancher groups hope country of origin labeling will come back for beef and pork, possibly with a rewrite of NAFTA. I'm Annie Baxter for Marketplace.
Today was a relatively busy day on Wall Street, not gains and losses wise, as you'll hear if you stick around for the numbers, but in trading volume. Here's why. Today is the annual reshuffling of the popular trading benchmarks known as the Russell Indexes. Marketplace's Aaron Trank has that one.
The Russell 1000 tracks the largest roughly 1,000 companies based on their stock market value, and the Russell 2000 tracks those just below that. But companies rise and fall, says Santa Clara University professor Mayer Statman.
There is a need to change the composition of the index to drop some and add some.
This time around, companies like JCPenney, Dillard's, Groupon, and Yelp all dropped out of the Russell 1000. Technology company NVIDIA graduated into the index. The Russell reshuffle is a big deal because a lot of mutual funds and exchange-traded funds are tied directly to what's on these lists, which in turn affects the average investor's portfolio. Stephen DeSanctis is an equity analyst at Jefferies.
Something like $9 trillion are benchmarked to their indices. So it becomes a pretty big trade.
And before the markets closed today, fund managers had to adjust their portfolios accordingly. Ivan Kajic does index research at ITG.
A company being added to Russell is going to result in all these fund managers purchasing shares of that company and vice versa.
The indexes are becoming an even bigger deal, says Kajic, because passive trading on the stock market has done better for investors than active trading. Just look at exchange-traded funds.
They're probably the fastest-growing area of the equity market, and I would say more than 90% passively benchmarked to some type of underlying index, such as the Russell.
On this day last year, the New York Stock Exchange surged to twice its normal trading volume. I'm Aaron Schrank for Marketplace.
Here's a lesson in the global supply chain, how it's changing, and what that is going to mean for a whole lot of companies that rely on that supply chain. The story comes to us via the Wall Street Journal and the cell phone industry. The latest entrant in the mobile phone sector is an extremely hard-to-come-by phone known as the WSJ-1, designed, engineered, and built in the southern Chinese city of Shenzhen, just north of Hong Kong. Lisa Lin had the story for the Journal. Hey, Lisa.
Hey, Guy.
So were you guys just sitting around the Journal Bureau in Hong Kong one day and said, hey, listen, let's make a phone?
We were looking for a way to tell the story of Shenzhen and the Po River Delta, which is pretty much the area that just makes all the smartphones, virtually all the smartphones in the world. And the Asia editor came up and he was like, why don't you guys make a smartphone? And that was when we were like, what? Okay. So a colleague of mine made some calls to Shenzhen. We looked on Alibaba.com, found a couple, narrowed it down, and that was it. We went down.
And you wind up making a phone that costs $70. I'm going to say that again, $70, the WSJ-1. And it works, and it's got, you know, some small amount of bells and whistles, and all of a sudden you guys were in business. It was crazy.
So given the fact that we were making 20 phones, I figured, you know, the phone would cost 200, 300 US at least.
Yeah.
And when I asked her the total, and she said it's $70 a phone, and I was like, whoa, you kidding me? So we did it.
There's a great phrase that one of the folks in your video uses, and he talks about technology as a commodity. And I wonder really if what's going on in South China now is technology manufacturing as a commodity. They have this thing that everybody wants.
Indeed. When China started to open up its economy to the world, and that was back in 1980, Shenzhen was earmarked as like a special economic zone.
Right.
So a lot of foreign companies came in. Think of guys like Nokia, mm-hmm. Motorola, and you know the economy just built up from there. So now you have a thriving supply chain for any sort of electronic product that you can think of.
Not that the Wall Street Journal is going to get into the telephone manufacturing business, and you guys are not a competitor, but what does sort of the larger lesson of you making the WSJ-1 mean for companies like Apple and Samsung, who you know, are the right now the giants?
So in 2012, the Chinese brands had a global market share of 20%. As of 2017, the first quarter of 2017, Chinese brands have doubled that market share. Hmm. So you're looking at a market share globally of 40%. Basically, they're eating Apple and Samsung's lunch. They're expanding in India, they're expanding in Indonesia, Africa, in some cases too. And these are the emerging markets that Apple and Samsung will have to go into.
So you've got these 20 WSJ1s. What are you going to do with them?
Yeah, good question.
Because I bet everybody wants one, right?
Yeah, there was a bit of a tussle in the office about who would get those phones.
Lisa Lin, she covers internet companies and technology for the Wall Street Journal in China. The link to that video, by the way, which is fascinating, is on our website. It is, of course, marketplace.org. Lisa, thanks very much.
Thank you, Kai. Pleasure.
Coming up,
Smokey the Bear signs are one of the favorites.
A sure sign that it's summertime. But first, let's do the numbers. All right, here you go on a Friday. The Dow Industrials down less than a tenth of 1%. 2 points close to 21,394. NASDAQ up 0.4%, about at 28.6265. S&P 500 gained 3 points, about a tenth percent, 24.38. For the 5 days gone by, the Dow advanced less than a tenth percent. The NASDAQ gained 1.8%. S&P 500 up 0.2%. Today, JCPenney rang up 4%. Today, you heard earlier, it got booted from the Russell Index, as did department store chain Dillard's, sold up 5.4%. Retailer Macy's, which has been struggling of late with its brick-and-mortar stores, tallied up 0.8%. Today, bonds fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note pretty much unchanged, 2.14%. You're listening to Marketplace. Hi, everybody. It's Kai Ryssdal. Marketplace is in the final week of fundraising before our books close for the year. We're asking you to step up and help support us today so that we can continue the in-depth, independent economic coverage you rely on. Any amount, even a small donation every month, counts. We appreciate your support. So please give today at marketplace.org/donate. And thanks. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Ryssdal. British Prime Minister Theresa May is walking the tightrope between a hard Brexit, that is just going almost no matter the terms, and her shellacking in the election a couple of weeks ago, which weakens her position. As she tries to negotiate some kind of trade deal with the European Union on the way out, she's got some extremely hard Brexiters demanding something called the nuclear option, unilateral free trade. From London, Marketplace's Stephen Beard explains what that might mean.
No wonder they call this the nuclear option.
5, 4, 3.
This would
two,
be a very drastic
one,
move.
0 now.
With massive repercussions. The idea is you scrap the tariffs on every import into Britain, the world's fourth biggest importer. This would, say its advocates, unleash a huge burst of economic energy.
Prices for consumers come down, we reckon, by 8% overall. And the competition that producers now face forces them to raise productivity.
Patrick Minford, professor of economics at Cardiff University, says if the EU won't give Britain a free trade deal, the UK should make a unilateral declaration, throwing itself open to free trade with everyone.
And as a result of that double process of consumers being better off and producers having to be more productive, GDP rises in the UK by about 4%, according to our calculations.
Sounds great in theory, but how does it sound in the practical world of business?
This is a security announcement. For your safety and security, CCTV is recording throughout this airport 24 hours a day.
At London's Stansted Airport, I met a young entrepreneur who thinks unilateral free trade is worth a try. Tom Cridland runs a small fashion company. Today he's flying off to meet one of his suppliers in Portugal. Cridland's alarmed at the prospect of Britain leaving the EU's tariff-free single market.
At the moment, we don't pay any duty on getting clothing from Portugal and Italy, our production, into the UK. But if Brexit were to happen, one of our biggest worries was having to suddenly start paying tariffs and duty on getting the clothing to England where we need it to be. So this idea of unilateral free trade is one that very much appeals to me.
Anyone importing products or raw materials might agree, but many others are not enthusiastic.
Good afternoon, Reed Still.
The boss of this steel company, Simon Boyd, is very pro-Brexit. He thinks it'll help his company trade even more successfully abroad. But he's not too keen on unilateral free trade.
Well, I'm all for free trade, but we have to protect some key industries in the UK that are essential to the running of the country.
Like the steel industry.
Steel industry is a good example.
For example, he says Britain must protect itself against what he calls the dumping of steel by the Chinese. Farming needs protection too. Unilaterally lowering trade barriers to all comers would make Britain vulnerable.
We would be in some difficulty if that kind of product we had to rely on people outside the UK. Well, we'd be at their mercy if there was any issues that ever arose in the future.
But economist Professor Minford says the benefits of tearing down trade barriers outweigh the disadvantages, and Britain has the chance to lead the world, encouraging other countries to go for the nuclear option, unilateral free trade.
Your critics, however, might argue that it's the economic equivalent of unilateral nuclear disarmament. In practice, very few are likely to follow suit.
The point is that with weapons, you're threatening other people. But with tariffs, you're threatening yourself. In unilateral free trade, you're getting rid of things that are actually hurting you.
But both the main parties in this month's general election promised further state intervention. The British appetite for free market solutions seems to be waning. Pressure for a soft Brexit, keeping close ties with the EU, is rising too. Unilateral free trade does seem a very distant possibility. In London, I'm Stephen Beard for Marketplace.
According to the National Park Service, there were more than 330 million visitors to our national parks last year. And most of them, if they were paying attention, saw a bunch of signage at the entrance to said parks. So today for our seasonal series, Summer, brought to you by the company that makes a lot of those signs, about 25,000 signs and markers last year, actually, from a workshop in Parlin, Colorado.
Imagination.
Wonderful products.
Brought to you by...
My name's Taylor Hefner, and I'm part owner in Wood Product Signs. In 86, my mom, Deborah, was working for the Park Service. She became pregnant with me, decided to try to make signs out of the garage. Worked out really good and has grown to where it is today. Smokey the Bear signs are one of the favorites. We get phone calls a lot, people calling, I want to buy a Smokey, and there's actually some rules in place because it's a government item.
Remember, only you can prevent forest fires.
They start with a raw piece of aluminum. That goes to a water jet table, and the water jet cuts the exact shape out of what the Smokey will look like. The edges get painted and sanded and cleaned and then into a box and shipped out to wherever it's going to live. Whenever we make a mistake here, we have employees that just love to take home mistake Smokies to put in their room. And it's borderline a fight on who gets. We give a hard time to everybody because they make the mistakes on purpose, so they get to take something home. What I enjoy about it probably the most is just being here in the country. We can only see about one or two neighbors from our shop. I grew up here on the property, so I enjoyed riding my bike around the yard. My mom, she certainly wouldn't talk about it, and even if you asked her directly, you wouldn't get anything out of her. But it's pretty neat to see what she's done, starting from herself in the garage, getting to put signs all over the U.S. And we're not trying to be a mega company. We don't want to take over the entire market. There's other companies that we want to see continue and do well. We want to have our part in it, put great signs going to some great places.
Taylor Hefner, he runs Wood Product Signs out of Parlin, Colorado. I know you want to see a picture of those Smokies, don't you? We got them at marketplace.org. final note on the way out today, in which it's entirely possible we are just doing it wrong. Here's the deal. According to Heidrick & Struggles, they're a senior executive search and consulting firm, the number of women on corporate boards in this country is actually falling. Women, they say, filled 27.8% of open boardroom seats at Fortune 500 companies last year. That is down from 29.8% of boardroom seats in 2015. How does that happen? I mean, I know how it happens, but come on, you guys, how does that happen? And with that, we are out of here. The Dow off less than a tenth of percent today, 2 points. NASDAQ was up about 0.4%, 28 points. S&P 500 up 0.3%. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Nancy Fargali. Sitara Nieves, I've known her for a long time. Sitara Nieves is the executive producer. Deborah Clark is the senior vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We will see you on Monday, everybody, unless I get fired. Have a good weekend, all right? This is APM.